Actions through raising awareness, education, and by sharing culture. Are you feeling drained at the end of the day? Or maybe you wake up in the morning feeling exhausted before the day even begins? Join us at 6:30 as we learn where our energy is going and how we can make empowering choices to stop the energy leaks. A naturopath and a life coach will be here to answer your questions and to fill us in on the secrets of living a life that will lead to greater levels of energy and empowerment. That's this Friday at 6 o'clock on Bread and Roses here on KBOO FM.
Embrace equality and claim our destiny.
Hi, I'm Cecil Prescott, co-host of More Talk Radio. Join me and Celeste Carey on Monday, June 1st at 8 a.m. We'll speak with peace activist and calypso singer and songwriter Dr. Patricia Morris of Peace by Peace, a nonprofit global network where women connect through the internet to promote sustainable peace. Join us for a discussion about how women around the world are organizing online for peace. That's Monday, June 1st at 8 a.m. on More Talk Radio on KBOO at 90.7 FM.
Come dance with me, and we'll change the future.
Good morning. You're listening to Radio Zine. I'm Marianne Barisonic. At 5 minutes past midnight on December 3rd, 1984, about 30 tons of toxic chemicals spewed into the air of Bhopal, India, from a Union Carbide insecticide factory. Estimates of the number of people killed immediately range from about 1,500 to over 8,000. But that was only the beginning. To mark the 25th anniversary, survivors of the tragedy are traveling throughout the world. Today in the studio, we have Satinath Sarange and Safreen Khan. Satinath, known as Sachu, is a metallurgical engineer turned activist who arrived in Bhopal a day after the disaster and stayed on to become a key figure in the struggle for justice in Bhopal. He's a founding trustee of the Sambhavna Clinic and a nonprofit clinic devoted to the holistic treatment of gas-affected persons in Bhopal. And Safreen Khan belongs to a family of six who lived behind the Union Carbide factory. Her mother was exposed to the gas in 1984. They moved, but discovered that the new house, the water was laced with the same poisons that killed thousands of people in Bhopal. But they have nowhere else to go, and her family continues to live in the area. Safreen and Sachu, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
So what was it like in Bhopal right after the disaster?
It was something that no one would be prepared for. It was so when I went there, I found just thousands and thousands of people in utter agony, people groaning in pain, people with eyes all swollen up and closed, and people gasping for breath. I found people lying helpless on the ground. I saw people walking a few steps and falling down. And what I also found that there were thousands and thousands of people from all walks of life who had come to volunteer to help people in distress. But the total magnitude of distress was just numbing.
So what's been the response of the Indian government?
Unfortunately, in the last 24 years, what we have seen is that the Indian government has been more concerned about the corporations, about Union protecting the interests of Dow Chemical and Union Carbide, than in helping the people of Bhopal. So we have been asking for a commission to provide long-term medical care and rehabilitation. But the promises are made. We fight our struggle for these demands. And yet the government, neither does it set up the commission, nor is it taking any legal action against Union Carbide and Dow Chemical.
So, Safreen, it was your mother who was exposed?
Safreen, aapki maa ko gas lagi thi?
हाँ मेरे मम्मी और पापा दोनों को ही गैस लगी है.
Both my parents were exposed.
And so you're kind of the second generation victims of Bhopal.
Yes, she is, and there are tens of thousands of such children.
Now, You and your sister Yasmin were the youngest members of a team of 50 survivors who walked from Bhopal to Delhi to meet with the Prime Minister early this year. That's about, what, 700 kilometers, about 450
about,
miles?
About a little more than 500 miles, yes.
Wow. How long did that take you?
Kitne din mein aap paidal pahunche?
Hum 20 February ko nikle the aur 28 March ko pahunche the.
We started our walk on February 20th from Bhopal and we reached New Delhi on 28th of March.
So what was the reaction of people as you did this walk along the way?
Raste mein logon ka kaisa raha aapke sath vyavhar jab Bhopal se Delhi jaane mein?
रास्ते में हमें बहुत तरह के लोग मिले और सभी अच्छे थे उन्होंने हमारी रास्ते में भी मदद करी जिस चीज से हो सकी और सभी हमारी मदद करते थे
We met a lot of good people along the way in the villages and we met people who helped us with whatever they could help us with so it was a very good experience
And when you met with the prime minister what was his reaction
और जब आप प्रधानमंत्री से मिले तो उनका क्या प्रतिक्रिया था
वो तो हमसे कभी मिले नहीं सामने आकर और हमने इतने कार्यक्रम भी किए और फिर उनको हमने दिल भी दिया कि इतने दिन हो जाने के बाद हम लोगों को लगा था कि उनके पास दिल नहीं है फिर हमने उनको दिल भी दिया उसके बाद उन्होंने हमारी मांगे मानी मगर वो हमसे खुद नहीं आकर मिले
ही नेवर मेट अस पर्सनली वी टोल्ड हिम सेवरल टाइम्स एंड वी डिड पार्टिसिपेटेड इन सेवरल एक्शंस to draw his attention and we also collected hearts paper hearts to give it to him because we thought that the prime minister did not have a heart so finally he did accept our demands and but he never met with us
so Sachu maybe you can tell us a little bit about what kinds of difficulties the survivors are having
one is that the survivors are confronted with one of the largest most powerful chemical corporations, which is Dow Chemical, which now owns Union Carbide. There is a long history of the U.S. government support to both Union Carbide and Dow. So there, people in Bhopal are confronted with this power of this mighty corporation that has the support of the mightiest government in the world and has the Indian government following its directions. So that's one big problem. The other big problem is that the government considers the lives of these people who are not in the production circuit or in the consumption circuit as expendable people.
When you say that these are people who aren't in the production or the consumption circuit, so the people who were living near the insecticide plant weren't workers there?
No, hardly anyone was a worker. And if at all, if a few 100 people ever got work, that was as contract laborers for a few days. But most of the people who worked there were comparatively more privileged. So they used to live in cleaner areas and posher areas of the town.
And what kind of health problems are the people experiencing?
Today we have more than 100,000 people who are chronically ill from their exposure to the gas. We have in our clinic every day between 150 and 180 people come. And we have 23,000 survivors who are registered for care at our clinic. And we see people coming with breathlessness, with joint pains, with fatigue, women with a range of menstrual irregularities. We find people with loss of sensation and power in the limbs, like paralysis. We find too many people with anxiety, depression, panic attacks. And then we have also done research that has been published in the JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association, that shows that even the next generation carries the mark of Union Carbide's poisons. In addition, you have about 30,000 people who have been poisoned through groundwater contamination because of reckless dumping of hazardous waste by the company. So among them, we see a lot of skin disorders. We see gastrointestinal problems. We find anemia very, very prevalent. More men have anemia than women, which is unusual. And among all of this population, exposed population, either to gas or to contaminated groundwater, we find alarming rise in cancers, various kinds of cancers, tuberculosis, and birth defects. A range of birth defects.
Now, you had said that you're seeing the mark on another generation. So is there genetic changes that you're seeing?
There has been some studies that have shown that there were chromosomal aberrations caused by gas exposure. And so it is quite likely that few more generations will have to suffer from this single acute exposure.
And it sounds like even though it's been 25 years, there hasn't been a lot of cleanup at the site because Safreen's new house, the groundwater is still contaminated.
Yes, that's true. And the contamination is spreading. And no cleanup has been done because Union Carbide just dumped the waste and left. And when Dow Chemical took over in 2001, they refused to do any cleanup. They said that we can't be held responsible for a factory we never ran in a place we never went. And they forgot that that by taking over the assets of Union Carbide, they were also taking the liabilities.
Right, right. So it sounds like there's just a huge amount to overcome for the survivors. How is your clinic funded?
We refuse to take money from corporations or corporate charities or large funding organizations. Our clinic is funded by small donations by up to 15,000 people, individuals. And also we receive all the royalties from this book that Dominique Lapierre, French author, wrote on the Bhopal disaster called It Was 5 Past Midnight in Bhopal. So that's how we are funded.
I'm Marianne Barasonic, and my guests today are Satchu and Safreen, and we're talking about the 25th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster. Now, it seems to me like you would think after 25 years, even some of these chemicals would start to break down naturally, and is that doesn't sound like that's happening either.
That's happening, but we do not know which way it is going because it is quite possible that some of them are more poisonous after degradation. Also, we have to consider that we have a mixture of different chemicals. We have all kinds of chlorobenzenes, dichlorobenzene, trichlorohexachlorobenzene. We have chloroform. We have carbon tetrachloride. There's a range of that. We have phthalates. We have heavy metals like mercury, sometimes million times more than what EPA suggests as background. Mercury, chromium, nickel. So it's a cocktail, and the quantities are high. We're talking of thousands of tons of waste containing these chemicals.
Well, the economy in India has been booming, and you would think that this would make the Indian government kind of more feeling a responsibility to take care of people because they can't keep saying, "Well, we can't possibly do this because there's no money."
Yeah, but that is one. I mean, the economy is doing well, but the people are not doing so well at all. In fact, what we find is the large majority in India, including the Bhopal victims, their conditions are getting worse. Because in this booming economy phase, what the government has decided, irrespective of the political party, it could be the Congress or it could be the BJP, the other party, but both are committed to getting foreign direct investments as the number one priority at all costs. And they are willing to look away about people's conditions and about the laws of the laws of the country. So now we have in our country what's called special economic zones where none of the environmental laws or the labor laws or any laws would be applicable where the investors could come and do whatever they wanted.
So as opposed to this disaster making the worker safety laws in India stronger, what they've done is, it sounds like they've done the opposite, and created these free-for-all zones where anything goes.
Exactly. They have eroded workers' rights, whatever they were, and made environmental laws more lax, regulation more lax for these special economic zones. And in fact, Dow Chemical was offered this PCPIR, which is Petrochemicals and Petroleum and Petrochemicals Investment Region. Each of them are supposed to be 250 square kilometers. And the Dow was asked to start its operations in Nandigram in West Bengal. And too many people were killed and shot at because they didn't want to give their land. And finally, the people managed to retain their land. But that's the way the Indian government wants the country to go.
So it sounds like even though you're not being occupied by the British anymore,
yeah.
which for so long India was, there's this economic occupation yeah. where you have a front of a government, but
yeah.
it's actually just as exploitive as if you had yeah. foreign armies there.
Exactly. And we have this new suited army, and they are occupying everything. They are occupying farmers. That's why there are so many farmers committing suicide every day. Thousands of people are dying. And that's because the GMO, the companies that deal with genetically modified seeds are getting in. So it's more than an invasion now, because it's invasion into areas of life that were not invaded by even the first company, which is the East India Company, which is the British government.
Because at least with the East India Trading Company, there was the rural life that was pretty much left yeah. alone, except for the horrendous taxing policies and yeah. that sort yeah. of thing.
Now, each of these companies, like Procter & Gamble or whatever you have, they now, Kellogg's, they are entering the rural market. They have special wings to deal with, which deal with the local language and deal with local traditions and trying to change that.
This is amazing. I guess because in the U.S. we really don't get that much information about what's yeah. really going on in India.
Yeah.
And is there sort of a grassroots movement to try to counter some of this?
There is a lot. I mean, in the tradition of the poor themselves in India, there's a lot of community life. I mean, the one big reason why people in Bhopal survive despite all this chemical trespass and the not getting rehabilitation is because people support each other so much. And what these new invasions or corporate invasions are doing is trying to break this community life, individualize as it is in the developed West. And there are resistance everywhere. Even now that the toxic empire is spreading so much and making inroads into what are known as backward areas, even there is opposition by local people and in most cases led by local women against these kind of invasions. Yeah, you take mining and in chemical industry and plus in areas where they have come up some nuclear power. These are facing confrontation everywhere.
So, Safreen, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your family. Have they received any compensation?
आपके परिवार में लोगों को मुआवजा मिला?
नहीं, कोई से कागज हमारे यहाँ गड़बड़ हो गए थे तो उसकी वजह से हमारे परिवार को कुछ भी पैसा नहीं मिला.
माँ को भी नहीं मिला?
नहीं.
No, we did not receive compensation because we were told that our papers were not in order.
And what kind of papers?
किस तरह के कागजात मांगे थे?
जो पुराना मेरे राशन कार्ड होता था तो हमारे पापा का एक हमारे वहीं पर रहते हैं नाना तो उनके उसमें नाम था तो असल जो अदालत में दिखाना होता है कागज तो वो नहीं दिखा पाए थे.
वन ऑफ द थिंग्स यू हैव टू शो इज अ फैमिली राशन कार्ड एंड बट माय फादर हैड हिज नेम इन सम अदर फैमिलीज हिज रिलेटिव्स फैमिलीज राशन कार्ड सो दे डिड नॉट allow that, and so he was denied.
So is this a common situation where...
Yeah, this has happened to a large number of people who were genuinely actually affected but who could not get compensation, and their numbers is in tens of thousands.
So has anybody done like a comprehensive survey of the number of people who've been affected? I mean, you said you thought the number was about 100,000.
No, number 100,000 is the number of people who are chronically ill today because of their direct exposure in it. But the number of people who were exposed, that was like a whole city. It's according to official figures, it is 572,000. So it's more than 500,000 people.
And you have the one clinic.
Yeah.
Are there other clinics that are helping people? I mean, that seems
the
like...
Other places for healthcare are the ones that are opened by the government, which is the 9 hospitals. Mm-hmm. And they have plenty of funds. I mean, the government has spent more than $300 million or so in all this work. But the problem is that the treatment that people are getting there is possibly causing them more harm. because Union Carbide still hasn't given information on the leaked gases or on what they do to the people's bodies.
So they don't even know what exactly they were exposed to?
Yeah. Because it was not just methyl isocyanate, but there was also hydrogen cyanide and monomethylamine, and it is understood that at least 17 other chemicals.
Okay.
Whether there was dioxin or not, we do not know.
And your clinic is taking a holistic approach to the treatment.
Can exactly. We saw that what we found was in the 10 years, 12 years before we started our clinic, was that people were not getting better. If there was at all they were getting any relief, it was temporary. It lasted as long as they were taking their medicines. We also found there was an indiscriminate prescription of antibiotics, steroids, painkillers, and psychotropic drugs that were causing possibly more harm. And ironically, the chemical disaster was a windfall for the pharmaceutical corporations. We found that Pfizer and Glaxo were making a killing out of 500,000 people needing medicines every day. Considering all of this, we started a clinic in which we offer treatment through modern medicine, yes, but we have integrated that with medicine through Ayurveda, which is the indigenous system of healing mostly based on herbs, and which includes Panchakarma, which is a detoxification procedures. And we have treatment through yoga. And we have found in the last 13 years that it is possible to develop and treat people in safe and simple and inexpensive and effective ways through integration of these different systems of medicine.
So you've been traveling, I know, in the U.S. Are you planning on going to other countries?
No, right now we're just doing U.S. for about 6 weeks. We have visited now more than 30 places now.
Right.
And then we have been out of Bhopal for long and we cannot afford to be out for long. But we will be having another campaign tour in Europe and UK in July.
Ah, okay. And Suffrine, how old are you?
16.
16. And have you spent a lot of time outside of India?
Aap pehle Hindustan ke bahar kabhi gaye?
No. First time.
First time, huh? So, what would you like to say to the people who are listening about your situation? And is there a website that people can go to?
Yeah, we have two websites. One is on the campaign, which is www.bhopal, which is bhopal.net. And the other is www.bhopal.org. That's on the clinic and what it does.
Yeah. Okay. And Suffrine, anything you'd like to say to people?
आप कुछ बोलना चाहेंगे जो आप इसके जो सुन रहे हैं उनको?
हाँ, यही कहना चाहते हैं कि सब भोपाल की मदद करें. भोपाल में अभी भी 25 साल हो चुके और वहाँ के लोग लड़ रहे हैं और अभी भी वहाँ पर इंसाफ नहीं हुआ है. तो हमने जो जन सुनवाई की मांग रखी थी, हम सेनेटरों से और है ना कांग्रेस में से मिले, हमने उनसे जन सुनवाई की मांग रखी थी कि है ना जन सुनवाई हो जिसमें डाउ के लोग और हमारे लोग हों, जिससे डाउ से पूछा जा सके कि उसने जिम्मेदारी क्यों नहीं ली और उसे जिम्मेदारी दी जा सके. और एक साइनो लेटर हमने कहा था. तो यहाँ के जो लोग हैं, यहाँ के सेनेटरों को है ना फ़ोन करें और चिट्ठी लिखें कि वो है ना जन सुनवाई जल्द से जल्द करें और है ना साइनो लेटर लिखें.
So yes, I would ask people who are the listeners would like that they appeal to them to help us in Bhopal. It has been 25 years and we are still fighting because justice has not been done in Bhopal. And there are two things that we are asking people here to do. One is that we have initiated this sign-on letter to Dow's board of directors. And this initiative is by Congressman Frank Pallone. And he's writing a letter to the Dow Board of Directors and in which a lot of the congressmen are expected to sign on. So one request is for people to call their congressman and ask that he or she sign on to this letter addressed to the Board of Directors. The other promise that we have got is that there would be a congressional hearing on Bhopal. And we look forward to such a hearing in which we expect that we will be also participating, and Dow Chemical will be asked why it has not accepted the liabilities of Bhopal when it has taken over Union Carbide. So we would like our listeners to write to their senators and their congressmen to see, ensure that a congressional hearing on Bhopal takes place as soon as it can be.
Yeah, again, this is another reminder that the world is getting smaller, and just because something happens in India, it doesn't leave us here unaffected, because it's the same companies, and we all need to kind of take a look and keep them doing something responsible, even though it seems like it's so far away. I'm Mary Ann Barasonic, and my guests have been Sachu and Safreen, and we've been talking about the Bhopal disaster. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you, Marian.
HIMU is a proud sponsor of An Evening with David Corton, sharing his new book, Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. The event, taking place Saturday, May 30th, begins at 5 p.m. with a celebration of Real Wealth community organizations, food and drink, followed at 7 p.m. by David Corton's presentation. The event takes place at First Baptist Church, downtown Portland, Southwest 12th and Taylor. That's An Evening with David Corton, Saturday, May 30th. More information is available on the web at realwealthpdx.com.
Sam Stone came home to his wife and family after serving in the conflict overseas. And the time that he served had shattered all his nerves and left a little shrapnel in his knee. But the morphine eased the pain, and the grass grew around his brain and gave him all the confidence he lacked. With a purple heart and a monkey on his back, there's a hole in daddy's arm where all the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing.
Good morning and welcome to a KBOO Public Affairs special program, an update on the Oregon's Guard Home campaign, the statewide effort to challenge the deployment of Oregon's National Guard to Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm William Seaman, your host for our discussion this morning, and with me in the studio today is Dan Handelman. Dan Handelman works for the Peace and Justice Works Iraq Affinity Group, and he's the state coordinator of the campaign to keep Oregon's Guard in Oregon. Dan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me here, Will.
And on the phone from Wisconsin, we're very fortunate to have with us Ben Mansky. Ben Mansky is an attorney working with the Liberty Tree Foundation for a Democratic Revolution, and he's the national coordinator for the Bring the Guard Home, It's the Law campaign. Ben, thank you for being a part of this morning's discussion.
You bet, William. Thanks for having me.
And we also want to invite our listeners to take part this morning. You can call in with your questions for our guests this morning at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Please join us in this very important discussion. I'd like to start with Ben Mansky. Ben, first of all, can you give us a bit of history of the Bring the Guard Home campaign? Why focus on the National Guard, and what is the basis for these efforts to block their deployment to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Absolutely. There is a state representative in the state of Vermont, Michael Fisher, from the township of Lincoln, who had authored a resolution which the Vermont legislature adopted several years back opposing the war in Iraq. And Michael Fisher, after having done that, still felt powerless, like so many of us did at that time. He said, you know, we've spoken, the American people have spoken, in the polls and the streets and successive elections, and yet Congress doesn't seem to be able to end the war. The president's not going to do it. What can I do at the state level? What can I do locally to have a real impact? And he introduced a resolution on January 29th of 2008 that was the first of these Guard Home legislation that we've seen sweeping the country since then. So that was the beginning. It was one legislator from a small town saying, what can I do? And I think the reason why you've seen this campaign focused on the National Guard spread around the country is that there are millions of Americans who are in a similar position, who have done everything that we're supposed to do to end this illegal war, but have been unable to have a real impact through the old channels. The reality about the National Guard is that when somebody enlists in the National Guard, they're doing so as part of what we call a dual enlistment system. So you enlist in the Oregon National Guard, and you're also enlisting in the National Guard of the United States. What this means is that for the National Guard, as opposed to other branches of the U.S. Armed Forces, the states have a role. They've historically had a very, very important role. That role has been diminished over the last 100 years, but there is a remaining role. And what we're seeing happen now in Oregon and Wisconsin and Maryland, and actually there are 24 states now where campaigns are either well underway or beginning, is that people are going to their legislators and saying, we want to make sure that when our National Guard units are called up for deployment, that there's a lawful basis for that deployment, that it's not a situation like what we've experienced with Iraq these past years, with the president continuing the war despite the absence of any congressional authorization. And that's basically what the legislation does in most states at this point, is that it says that it's the duty of the governor to review those call-up orders, to review the orders that come down from the Department of Defense calling up a National Guard unit for deployment overseas, to make sure that there's a lawful basis for it, that it's not a situation where you have a runaway president.
And has the National Guard been used in this way in other overseas conflicts in the past, or is there a change in the magnitude of their deployments in these wars?
There's been a major change in the magnitude. We didn't see the Guard used for offensive purposes in any real significant way until really the 1990s. You saw it beginning with the Persian Gulf War. You saw it with the Bosnia-Yugoslavia War. But really what we've seen since the beginning of these two 9/11 wars is the reliance on the National Guard by the U.S. Armed Forces, by the President, has gone to a new level, to the point at which three successive Secretaries of Defense have said that the occupation of Iraq would not have been possible but for the reliance on the National Guard. Over 700,000 members of the National Guard and reserves have been sent over there. And the reality is that the moment that a state legislature adopts this legislation and a governor reviews the authorization for the use of military force in Iraq and says, that's expired, there's no lawful basis for our Guard units to go overseas, that's going to be a major international incident. And it's going to be very important, not only in terms of the question of the wisdom of the policy of the war in Iraq, but also in terms of deeper questions that are more long-term, questions about war powers, questions about democracy, and questions about empire. And I think that's why this campaign has gathered such steam in so many states.
Now, with the Obama administration stepping up the U.S. war in Afghanistan, are you worried that Democratic majorities in the House and Senate will provide a new authorization for deploying the National Guard abroad?
Well, there's separate authorizations in Afghanistan and Iraq, and there are strong bases for believing that both of those authorizations are no longer valid. I think the question of what Congress does is something that should be relevant, that should be front and center. But unfortunately, Congress and the courts have taken Congress's primary war powers role, its war declaring role, its role in terms of determining the scope of these missions. They've taken that role and they have relegated it to a secondary role. So, sure, if the Congress comes forward and they want to take up a new authorization, there will be a public debate. My suspicion is that members of Congress don't want to be on the hot seat. and that if there were to be a vote, then I think they would find themselves in a very difficult situation, because the reality is that opposition to U.S. deployments to Afghanistan is at an all-time high, according to U.S. opinion polls.
Well, let's bring the state of Oregon and Dan Handelman into the discussion. Dan has been involved as a coordinator of the local efforts, of the statewide efforts, to challenge the deployment of the Guard. When did the campaign here in Oregon get started, and what form has it taken, and where are we in terms of legislation at the State House and Senate?
This specific campaign to keep Oregon's Guard in Oregon started a year ago in May last year. It was based on reading about the Vermont bill, and then we actually took that bill and modified it to bring it around and try to find a legislator who would help us introduce it. And here we found Representative Chip Shields of Northeast Portland, who helped introduce the bill in late last year. And even before that, in 2004, Peace and Justice Works was looking for a way to, as Ben said, find a local means to end this illegal war, illegal occupation in Iraq. So we started a troops home campaign where we were having people write postcards and letters to Governor Kungowski, urging him to please keep the guard home because we didn't think that there was any reason for our National Guard to be going over there. And we didn't have the tools at that point that the national campaign has provided. And when Ben says that the authorization is no longer valid for Iraq, the 2002 authorization specifically says that the military force is being used to protect the United States against the threat posed by the country of Iraq. And Iraq has a government that supposedly is our ally now. So they're not posing a threat to the United States. And the only other thing it says that we can do over there is to enforce UN Security Council resolutions against the government of Iraq. And there's no reason to be enforcing UN Security Council resolutions with military force at this point. Saddam Hussein is dead. We can have long discussions about all that. But the point is that the authorization is expired. And you were asking about Afghanistan. When we started our campaign, we looked at Afghanistan and the war on terror and felt like it was also a place where our guard was going to be probably sent, and that the authorization there says the president can choose any country that he says had something to do with 9/11 and use military force there, as long as he says that there's people within that country that had something to do with 9/11. And that is way too broad. I mean, you know, if you're going to declare war, you say this is the person, the country that you're having war against, this is the government you're having a war against. You just can't declare a war against an idea. And so we think that that one's too broad. So it's weird. On the one hand, we've got this Iraq authorization. It's expired. It's too narrow. It's done. On the other hand, we have this other one that's drawn way too broadly.
I want to continue on the discussion of where things stand in the Oregon legislature, but I first want to go to our caller. We have one caller on the line. Caller, what question do you have for our guest this morning?
I guess more maybe it's kind of a statement. So I guess what we're really seeing is the powers to be, the bankers, the New World Order, calling the shots now with our military. They're using their military for their own financial advancement, so it's out of the hands of the Congress and the people, plus the Congress is owned by the corporations. And so now what we have is, because I like the idea of pulling our military out, the National Guard needs to be home to protect us from our own selves, really. I mean, we're defenseless right now against anybody that was to come in. Plus, you know, in Boston, they're getting ready to give the police M16s, okay? And then, because of the lack of the military having the people in the army, Obama's administration is now getting ready to target 16, 17, 18-year-old children to come into the war. So,
caller, do you have a question for our guest this morning on the Oregon Guard Home campaign, please?
Well, I like the Oregon Guard campaign. I think we need to get behind this and really take back our protections. And my question is, how do we do that and also keep the police be armed? Because we won't need the police with machine guns if we have our National Guard home.
Thank you, caller. Dan, it's interesting what the caller says about protection from our own police, because something I didn't mention in the introduction is you're very active on police accountability issues. Do you see a link with the deployment of the Guard and these broader questions of militarization of our society through the police force, through the use of things like Joint Terrorism Task Force and so on?
Oh, certainly there's a connection. And Peace and Justice Works has a project group called Portland Cop Watch, and we connect that the idea that the police are like the military on a local level, where they're using force to put forward the state's policies. And we have been trying to keep the police in Portland accountable. And certainly the police in Portland have AR-15s, which is the civilian equivalent of the military M16. And we don't like them having those assault rifles. And it's quite another story. It's kind of sort of a sidetrack, but yeah, yes, there's definitely a connection. But to answer your question that I didn't answer before about where the bill now, for your listeners, the bill that we have that we were trying to push through is called HB 2556, House Bill 2556. And there's an amendment to it called 2556-1. We've got bipartisan support because a conservative Republican from Southern Oregon, Dennis Richardson, worked with Representative Shields on this amendment. And he helped scare up enough votes for us where we have enough votes, we think, to pass this bill in the House. And 2556-1 basically just reads, the Oregon National Guard is limited to service on behalf of the state of Oregon unless the National Guard is called into federal service pursuant to a valid congressional enactment consistent with the United States Constitution. And in reality, you don't even have to have a law that says that, right? Nobody wants our National Guard. I mean, presumably our governor wouldn't want our National Guard going off unless there is a valid congressional enactment saying that the president had the right to deploy them. But you'd be surprised how much pushback we're getting from people up in the state capitol in Salem. They're saying some people think that this is unconstitutional. Some people think that we have to give President Obama a chance. Some people think that if we pass this law, somehow it's going to come back and hurt the guard troops on the ground. And we're just getting all these excuses, but we think we have enough votes to pass it. So we've been trying to get the Speaker of the House, Dave Hunt, and the Chair of the Rules Committee, Arnie Roblin, to agree to a work session, what's called a work session. They've already had a hearing in March, and we're hoping we're going to get a work session in the next week or so, or else it's not going to make it through the Senate and to the governor's desk. So that's what we've been working on really hard, is trying to push the Speaker and the Chair to hold a work session.
So we're really at a very important turning point for this legislation. It seems like we're so very close to seeing this come to a vote and perhaps even pass. It certainly looks promising with the vote count that you suggested there. And yet it seems to be stalled. A kind of a procedural obstacle has come up in the way. Do you think that something that listeners can do, people who are concerned about this, is to actually try and bring their voice into the discussion with our representatives? And I mean, should they be calling?
Yeah, absolutely.
These representative Dave Hunt and Arnie Roblin?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would also add, there's other members of the Rules Committee who could also have an influence on whether this gets a work session. And those folks are Mary Nolan, who's also from the Portland area, Sarah Gelser, Tobias Reed from the Beaverton area, Chris Edwards from the Eugene area, and Representative Girard and Jensen. The phone number, there's a toll-free number, actually.
Everybody got your pen and paper ready?
Yeah, please.
To write this down, as well as maybe you might mention these particular representatives,
right,
as well. Because this is one of those moments, it seems to me, this is one of those moments in history where potentially we are at a balancing point. And the direction of the House of Representatives and the Senate here in Oregon could be making a very significant contribution to changing the direction on these conflicts overseas. It's a wonderful example of acting locally and having the impact globally. So, yes, I hope listeners are ready with their pen and paper. And
right.
Who do they need to contact?
Okay, I will say that. But first, I want to clarify something for the listeners and something about our particular campaign. One of the reasons we really geared up for this last year is that we knew that our guard was set to be deployed to Iraq this summer. And a lot of our effort was to try to prevent that exact deployment from going away. At this point, the guard is in Georgia and on their way to Iraq. And it's, whatever slim chance we had before, the chance is even slimmer that, the governor would recall them from being halfway to Iraq at this point. So at this point, it's more to pass this legislation to prevent this from happening again in the future. But it would, as you say, it would set a historical precedent. So the two main people you're wanting to contact are our Speaker of the House, Dave Hunt. He's from the Gladstone area, if you live out that way, and he's your representative. He'll probably want to hear from you even more. And Arnie Roblin from Coos Bay, who's the chair of the Rules Committee. And they can be reached this 800 number at the Capitol, 1-800-332-2313. And there's also more information.
What number is that again, please?
It's 1-800-332-2313. And I was going to say there's more information up on the Peace and Justice Works website. If you click on the Guard Home campaign little icons or the words that say, click here to learn more about the campaign.
And what's the website?
www.pjw.info.
A terrific website with lots of resources. I want to get back to our guest in Wisconsin, Ben Mansky. Where do things stand in other states? This is really a nationwide campaign. Where do things stand? Are we as close in other states of the Union?
At this moment, no. Oregon is on the cusp. The reality is that this campaign As I mentioned earlier, it began in Vermont. It began in an election year, however. And so things were slow to start last year, but it's really ramped up in just the last 5 months. We've had hearings in several states in New Mexico and Maryland. We actually had a floor vote in New Hampshire. That was unexpected. We had not expected we would get a vote in New Hampshire. Unfortunately, it failed, but it actually attracted a lot more support than they had expected in that state. But as you might expect, knowing the political culture of various northern states, Oregon, Wisconsin, and Vermont have been at the forefront of this. What we'd really like to see, speaking as a Wisconsinite, but also as a former Stumptowner, I lived out there for a couple years, we'd like to see you guys chalk up a first win here. Because what will happen is you may not be able to impact that deployment that's going forward right now, but you will be on the front page of newspapers all over the world. And that will have a major impact in Congress. It will have a major impact in other states. In Wisconsin, we're looking at a vote coming up in September, and luckily in Wisconsin, we have the legislative leadership sponsoring the bill. We feel like we have a very good chance here, but it will make an enormous difference in some of these other states if in Oregon, if your lower chamber, your Senate, adopt this. And the other thing I just want to point out, you were talking about sort of the deeper questions about the militarization of society, and it also, you know, gets to a deeper question about democracy, which is if we aspire to be a democratic country, not just in rhetoric but in reality, what kind of national defense will we have? Will we have military bases in over 100 countries around the world? Will we have a professional army? Will we have private corporations increasingly taking on military roles? Or will we have a national defense force which is actually democratically controlled and made up of the people themselves? And I would submit to you that the entity that is closest to that is our National Guard, and that's historically what was intended. In fact, until just over 100 years ago, the militia, which is our modern National Guard, was something 6 to 10 times larger than the standing army that we had at that time. And there are some good reasons for that. So what I would say to people is this is not just about Oregon, Iraq, and Afghanistan, as vital as these issues are, but it is also about beginning the process of reclaiming national defense, not simply being a peace movement that gets out in the streets and says, no, stop, bring the troops home, cut off the funding, impeach the president. Not always being a peace movement that's in resistance, but actually being a movement that changes our system of national defense in America so that wars become less likely and so that military policy is more directly accountable to the American people.
And we're talking with Ben Mansky, who's very kindly on the phone from Wisconsin. He's an attorney working with Liberty Tree Foundation for a Democratic Revolution, and he's the national coordinator of the Bring the Guard Home, It's the Law campaign. And in the studio with me is Dan Handelman, who's the Oregon State coordinator for the Guard Home campaign here in Oregon. Of course, we welcome your calls. If you'd like to take part in the discussion this morning, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. We have a caller. Caller, do you have a question for our guests?
I do. Thank you, William, for taking my call. Question for Mr. Mackey, is it?
Mansky.
Mansky, I'm sorry. Oh, and by the way, an easy way to remember that 800 number in Salem is 3322-313. But, Mr. Mansky, now George Wallace was a bad example of an Alabama governor gone south with the idea of states' rights. However, are you, in your position in this national campaign, which is so justified constitutionally, are you addressing some of the states that otherwise might be reluctant in their legislatures and governorships, the idea of this is a state's rights issue, and can that be used to the advantage of what you're doing rather than resurrect the old ghosts of racism and the state's rights used for that in the past? I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you, William.
Thank you, caller.
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it gets to something deep, which is that there are many people of many walks of life, many political persuasions, who are concerned about federal power, who are concerned about empire, who believe that the United States should be a country which does not go abroad looking for dragons to slay, in the words of one of our former presidents. And in fact, we have seen in various states, in Oregon, also in Wisconsin, support from libertarians, from Republicans who are genuine conservatives, not hypocrites like our former president. And there is a real relationship that is being built here that gets across some of the divides that have really separated a lot of people in the last couple of generations. So the reality is that this is not really a states' rights issue. It doesn't address the 10th Amendment. It's not about reserve powers. But what it is it is a federalism issue that's very important. You would think that these conservative textualists in the Supreme Court would look at the text of the Constitution and see what it says so plainly, which is that Congress has the responsibility for providing the conditions under which the militia may be called into national service. And those are three, and they're spelled out in the Militia Clause of the Constitution. Number one, to repel invasion. Number two, to suppress insurrection. And number three, to enforce the laws of the United States, which is understood to mean domestically here. That was the understanding that almost all citizens shared until very recently. And it was for that reason that the National Guard and the militia before it were not deployed to Mexico, were not deployed to Canada when we had wars with Britain and with Mexico. It was simply not even a question. But what has happened over the last 100 years is that as the power of the federal government has grown, and as we have seen this capture of the federal government by major corporations and also the military-industrial complex, which has arisen in partnership with it, is that we have seen the destruction of the militia, and that we've seen the destruction of the National Guard, and we've seen the destruction of our Constitution. So that is a reason why I think you are seeing conservative Republicans who are genuine conservatives, while you're seeing libertarians join with Democrats and independents and Greens in working on this campaign.
And I'd like to mention something, a couple of events coming up, somewhat related to some of the themes that have come up this morning. First of all, as you heard during the break there, David Corton, he's the author of When Corporations Rule the World and The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community. He's going to be speaking on Saturday, May 30th. There is a 5 p.m. celebration of real wealth, community organizations, and food and drink will be served. And then at 7 p.m., David Corton will be speaking. And that is, where is that? Well, oh my goodness. We're going to have to wait for that announcement to come up a little bit later because it's not on the flyer I'm looking. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, it's that the First Baptist Church in downtown Portland, Southwest 12th and Taylor. That's the First Baptist Church, downtown Portland at Southwest 12th and Taylor tomorrow, May 30th, 7 p.m. for David Corton. And then also, there's a Jobs with Justice full mobilization happening, United for Oregon March and Rally, and that's Sunday, June 7th. At 11:30 a.m. at the East Bank Esplanade between Southeast Main and Southeast Taylor. And that is leading up to a 1 p.m. march across the Hawthorne Bridge. And this is the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, members and community, political, religious, and labor leaders who are going to be converging from across the state in a huge march in downtown Portland. This is to try to change the priorities of the various responses, the bailouts and so on, to the economic crisis. And again, that's Sunday, June 7th. Now, just to remind folks, we are coming up at the end of the hour, so I want to give Dan Handelman a chance to maybe touch on some points we haven't talked about and to summarize what can people do to get engaged with this issue.
Okay, well, I just wanted to also mention that the campaign is not just made up of Peace and Justice Works. We would never have gotten this far by ourselves. There's 56 organizations that have supported the campaign, and that we circulated petitions last year that we ended up raising about 7,200 signatures from Oregonians all over the state in every county and every district, House and Senate district. And we delivered those petitions in January. We also have been continuing to put pressure on our legislators, and people who read the War Oregonian might have seen that on yesterday's paper, we held a news conference down in Salem with Cindy Sheehan yesterday, or on Wednesday, and to demand a vote. And that's what we're asking people to do now, is to demand a work session and vote on House Bill 2556, so that it can be modified as amended to 2556-1. We know we have the votes for that, and we want to see that happen. And the work session has to happen in the next few days, or the bill is not going to make it through this session. There are some possibilities of other means to convey this message to the federal government that we might be able to also pull off before the end of the session. And we're trying to figure out ways to make that work, but we'd really prefer to get this bill passed, 2556, and call Chair Arne Roblin of the House Rules Committee or Speaker of the House Dave Hunt at 800-332-2313.
And Ben Mansky, any closing thoughts? We have about a minute.
Absolutely. Well, I would say to everybody who's listening, the members of the Oregon National Guard and of other National Guard units who have been sent over to Iraq, they signed up for something different. They took an oath to our Constitution to serve all of us, and arguably they've been abused. So this is your opportunity as Oregonians to have a major impact, to help those members of the National Guard who are being impacted, to help the people in Iraq, to help restore democracy or to bring democracy to the United States. So please get behind the work that Dan and some of the other people in Oregon have been doing. It's been courageous work. Make those calls. Tell everybody you know to do the same.
Ben Mansky, thank you for joining us this morning.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's Ben Mansky of the Liberty Tree Foundation for a Democratic Revolution, working on as the national coordinator of the Bring the Guard Home, It's the Law campaign. And with us in the studio has been Dan Handelman. Dan Handelman, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks. Just a reminder, our website's www.pjw.info.
And that will wrap us up for this morning. Thank you for tuning into this special public affairs program about the Guard Home campaign in Oregon.